This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest in the studio is Keith Recker, who is the author of a new book, True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. Hi, Keith.
Hey, how are you both?
Pretty good. Keith, how did you get into color?
I have to say it's been a long and winding road. I come from a background of poetry and literature. And of course, you know, when you have that background, you have to do something. And I ended up having two separate careers, maybe three. One in big retail as director of home furnishings at Saks Fifth Avenue, Gump, San Francisco, and Bloomingdale's Direct Response. And another career in nonprofit as head of Aid to Artisans, as founder of the Hand Eye Fund and Hand Eye Magazine, and currently as pro bono creative director of the International Folk Art Market based out in Santa Fe. And my third career has been in trend and color forecasting with Pantone, WGSN, a little bit with Stylus, really trying to inject a sense of adventure, creativity, and relevance to their client base.
Now, when we did our episode where we interviewed Donna Karen, that was, she had part of the International Folk Art Market in the Urban Zen store, and we were surrounded by products from that market, but she didn't really talk about it in the interview. Can you tell us a little bit about the International Folk Art Market?
Yeah, absolutely. You were surrounded in the Urban Zen Holiday Market by, I think it was 29 different artists from all over the world. Mostly textiles in that collection, and things ranged from the most amazing hand-spun vicuña, hand-knit by artisans in Argentina, and the group that does these things is part of a biosphere management program in the high, dry plains of Argentina, where vicuña are an essential part. And the vicuña is harvested the Incan way, where the village surrounds the vicuña so that there's no sense of panic. They slowly move in until the animals can be sheared. It's a really touching story. So you were surrounded by 25 stories with that kind of depth and historic resonance. And the Folk Art Market is an annual event in Santa Fe. It happens every July. We bring together between 160 and 180 artists from all over the world, 50 plus countries, and they're bringing the best of what they make from a traditional point of view, sometimes from a personally adventuresome creative point of view, sometimes from a recycled and cutting edge social point of view. It's a real mix of creativity that from our US based experiences seems very out of the mainstream and therefore terribly exciting and motivating.
They must get a lot of just going to that and meeting each other and seeing what they all do all around the world. I mean, that must be just such an experience for an artisan who works in a community of artisans that do the same thing, and then meeting artisans who do wildly different things from other parts of the globe.
Well, you've already understood the thing that the artists themselves like the best about it. They love exchanging topics with each other, whether it's how to, whether it's, oh my God, you should try this. Sometimes they get together and collaborate after the market. So somebody shares, an all-white Chican embroidery piece from Lucknow, and they send it off to one of their new friends to be dipped in indigo, to be bandhani tie-dyed, to be transformed into something subtly and beautifully different. So the exchange is really the magic. Plus the sales. A lot of folks walk away from the market with a year's worth of income in their pockets based on a 22-hour event. We sell around $3.1 to $3.4 million worth of product in 21 hours, and all the artists get paid out 2 days later. So in 5 days, you go from setup to payout and arrivederci. It's an amazing operation.
It sounds like a really tight-knit community then, really. So is it hard to join that community, or who's finding new artisans for that?
It's a very tightly juried show. Artists from all around the world apply online, pictures and text, and there are two juries. There's a group of academics from museums around the world, mostly around the U.S., who look at it from the point of view is this really rooted in cultural assets, right, that we recognize, that there's techniques, color languages, languages of motif. Is it rooted somehow in community heritage? And then the second group answers the question, is this going to connect with the market? Does it represent a product? Does it represent a look? Does it represent a price point? And of course, is it super beautiful? I mean, that's the first question that we have to answer before we even proceed to the further analysis. So those two groups are responsible for curating something that really is unique in the world. There's nothing like it in the entire world.
So between that and what you're describing in your book about being in touch with all these natural colors, ways of getting color from the earth, from plants, a lot of this is about being in touch with what you're making and how it's being made. And I mean, we talk about the supply chain a lot, but most people aren't really at the root of their supply chain. They don't go back to, you know, not a lot of designers spend much time in cotton fields looking at different types of cotton as they're growing, what the fibers look like in different fields. I mean, they get finished product kind of textiles. What does it do for the world if people are more in touch with this stuff?
Well, I would love to answer your question in a complicated way.
Please. That's what the show is for.
I think we need to look at the heritage chain even as we look at the supply chain. If you look back at how we got where we are today in terms of what we make and how we make it, in terms of textiles especially, the 1856 invention of the first synthetic dye, Mauveine, right, by a teenage English chemist, Perkins, totally by accident. He was working with coal tar to try to find a synthetic quinine substitute, right, to treat malaria in the colonial era of the British Empire. And he discovered that something that he was making would dissolve in water and color rags in a really very attractive, sharp purple, reddish purple. That unleashed the willful exploration of using a lot of petrochemicals to substitute what were centuries, thousands and thousands of years of heritage. So, for example, the company that became BASF, right, the maker of the cassette tapes that some of us are old enough to have fetishized, started off by making a synthetic indigo. And interestingly, the synthetic indigo they made did not appeal because they had not really captured that the full charm of indigo went beyond just the indigo molecule. They had to go backward and realize that indirubin, a red molecule that would form in the process of indigo dyeing, was needed to give the color depth. So they had to go back and explore why nature was so much more beautiful than what they were at first capable of making. In any case, since 1856, we have lost so much knowledge. If you and I walked down the street today and looked at what people are wearing down the street, and we asked ourselves, well, how would you ever get that color using anything other than a chemical? We would have zero insight, chances are, right? We've left all of that behind. So the heritage chain, I think, has impoverished the richness of understanding that we used to have about what comes from our world and how it's made and how valuable it is. We've gotten to a point where we're so distant from our heritage chain that things have the virtue of plastic bags, of disposable, valueless product. After they've faded in the wash twice, we're done. There's a statistic out there that 80% of the clothing we buy ends up in a landfill within 1 year. And it's because we're so distant from people, culture, heritage, skill, invention, and talent that the things we buy are not worth holding on to. So then we go to the supply chain, right? And there really is, in as an extension of this heritage chain, a set of material knowledge that is still relevant in making textiles, that's still relevant in making clothing, and it's waiting for us to study it more and to really incorporate it into responsible, valuable fashion creation.
So is it being studied more? I almost want to go backtrack a little bit, because you are also doing color and trend forecasting for Pantone, for WGSN. And I think, you know, in you spoke initially about your climb in retail and hard goods, and that's when home goods were really right on the tipping point of becoming what everybody wanted. And something happened that made that directed you down this road towards color. I mean, obviously, you're always right brain, left brain. So what was that? Just as an introduction to why you are studying color the way that you are?
That's a really good question.
You know the answer, right? Because it was in the book.
I didn't study this question. I think as a student of poetry and literature, I came to realize that words are not the only way we communicate, right? We communicate through music, and we communicate through color. We communicate through gesture and movement. And these are all wordless ways of establishing meaning, right? We spin stories based on these things every day. There's a music in the tone of voice which is completely independent of what we're actually saying. That's one good example. There's a message that we convey with what we're putting on, right? All of us in our New York black, our prudent New York black. What story are we telling? This is a city where we do things. And I love the functionality of the outfits that we choose because we're too busy doing things to parade around like peacocks, right? There's a story that we spin with all of these things. And as a student of words, I also became really fascinated by the ways we do this without words. And that was really the beginning. From a trend in color forecasting point of view, at a certain point, I was working with Pantone on some licensing projects. And in telling their story as a brand, we realized, all of us working together, that I was just going beyond, you know, pitching Pantone for T-shirts and mugs, that I was really getting right at the heart of the matter. What is our psychological, spiritual thirst of the moment? How can we look at what's happening today to move into what's going to be happening 2-3 years from now? And how do we solve the challenges that we see coming through color and material choices so that people can be deeply satisfied?
So what role can a Pantone play in that? I mean, if there's a natural ability to achieve dyes versus chemical, how does that get started, and is it started?
I think like most creative companies, Pantone is customer responsive. And I do believe that eventually, you know, we will find the need from the client base to move into the discussion of natural ways to achieve the color spec that they offer. I think it's just a matter of time. I think the pressure is building, and it's a healthy pressure. So I'm looking forward to the day when we get there.
And it is doable.
It's
to achieve
doable.
The ranges that they have in a natural way.
I tell the story in the book of a woman named Michelle Whiplinger, who appeared in my office at Saks Fifth Avenue with 4 sample cases of cotton, wool, linen, Ramey, viscose, rayon. Dyed the most stunning spectrum of natural colors. Michelle had traveled around the world identifying sources of natural dyestuffs and worked very hard to come up with a language of natural dye extracts. So some of the work had been done already. You didn't necessarily have to boil bark. You could dissolve a lovely liquid in some water and prepare your fiber properly and achieve a gorgeous color. And in combinations of mordants, right, iron or aluminum or tannin, natural dye substances in various percentages of combination, Michelle was absolutely able to come up with every Pantone color that I could possibly have imagined. And she's just brilliant. She's given credit for changing the dye and color language of the entire fiber arts community in the Northwest of the United States. And I think her influence is actually much broader than that for people who were paying attention 25 years ago.
So when you're dealing with natural dyes, a lot of brands really rely on things always being the same. But with natural dyes, there's almost always variation. I was talking during Fashion Week with Angel Chang, who has this brand called Village Embassy. And she's gone to China, to a village really in the middle of nowhere, to work with people who've never used mechanized processes for making textiles. And she was showing me that she's got one pair of pants that was dyed at one part of the year and another that was dyed another part of the year with indigo, and the indigo doesn't take to the fabric during the winter because it's too cold to activate certain things in the fabric to grab the dye as it's kind of swimming around the fabric. So this stuff, it gets very complicated. And with the synthetics, it's always the same, it seems like. So how do we have that conversation with businesses and brands about kind of letting things float? And with stores, when they make a purchase, at wholesale and they expect a certain color to show up and there's variation that shows up. Mm-hmm. How do we have that conversation? What's important to think about there?
Well, I have a certain amount of faith in humanity. We evolved over millions of years to develop an exquisite sensory skill set as hunter-gatherers. And we survived for a very long time looking with our visual sense for clues about what we wanted and why we wanted it. This skill set still exists in us, and it is not overly entertained by sameness. I think as people, we would be far more stimulated in a retail environment to walk in and look for the texture and color that we loved as opposed to looking at a sea of sameness. So I really think that it's up to us as storytellers, it's up to us as designers, it's up to us as merchants to really engage the customer far more with the beauty and potential of natural substances than with the uniformity of a manufactured process.
Some of the fabric researchers that I've worked with in the past had always spent an inordinate amount of time at every fabric appointment talking about the yarns and the finishes and blah, blah, blah. It would be like, okay, we got to get out of here. So I imagine that these individuals are also having a lot of sustainable conversation. My question is, as you went through, and it was all Africa, where you're studying where you're talking about historical context, cultural context, I don't know, scientific context. Mm-hmm. But are there scientists that are actually working? I imagine it would be a scientist who would work with a mill. Are there scientists that are actually working with any of these people to try to find solutions that can scale? Can they scale, do you think?
That's a really good question. There are some people. I'm aware of a group in the Netherlands called Rubia Natural Colors, which moves from farm through final dye. There's Living Blue in Bangladesh, which is definitely farming natural indigo at some scale and making it available, whether they make the project or someone else makes the project using their indigo. There are people out there working at some scale. Are scientists paying enough attention on how to actually implement these resources? No, they're not paying enough attention. I would say that there's a lot about why natural dyes do what they do and work the way they work that is ill understood. Even something as basic and anciently used as a mordant, using iron or an aluminum compound to prepare the fiber to accept the dye, there's still an incomplete understanding at the molecular level about why that works the way it works. There's still room for us to improve our application of these principles, the efficiency of application of these principles. There's still room to challenge and change water consumption and waste disposal because we have an incomplete understanding of why these things work, let alone of why they're beautiful. Yeah.
We even teach children wrong. I mean, the idea of the color wheel where you've got the three primary colors, you've got red, blue, and yellow, and then blue and yellow make green, and red and blue make purple, and then red and yellow make orange. That's not true at all. I mean, especially in light. Like if you have yellow light and you have blue light and you combine them, you get blue light. And if you have a blue pigment and a yellow pigment and you combine them, what's happening isn't that you're making green. The yellow light and the blue light are both being absorbed, so you can see the green pigment that was already in the paint that you couldn't see before because the blue and the yellow were overwhelming it. And so suddenly the little flecks of green that were there are showing up. And the only way to really make green paint is to start with something green. You can't make green paint from blue and yellow. And we teach children yellow and blue make green, which is wrong.
They make the effect of green, but you're right. It's oversimplified, right? It's absolutely skipping all the interesting information that lies behind it. I would say that I'm going to extend your question a little bit.
Okay.
There's a way in which the ways natural dyes behave that engages the eye according to the principles you just outlined. that makes it a far superior viewing experience because your eye is actually challenged to assemble the color. It's a little bit like a pointillist feeling, right? That juxtaposed colors create an effect because they're juxtaposed colors. They're not one color. They're juxtaposed colors. If you look at what happens with indigo, we just mentioned indigo and indirubin, those two color influences are blended by your eye to create your experience of that color. You look at natural yellows. There's a chapter in the book about an invasive plant called Argyrotina adenophora, which yields beautiful yellows and is being used by a group in the foothills of the Himalayas because they're eradicating it to give the forest floor a chance to grow back with native plants. They're using it with a quick dip in the indigo vat. So you've got the yellow light being reflected from the fibers taking up the Argyrotina adenophora with the gentle coating of indigo, because indigo coats, it doesn't absorb, and the reflection of both of those wavelengths interacting with each other, it provides a beautiful, luminous, engaging color. It is not a flat chemical application onto a cheap t-shirt. It's a thing in and of itself. And our eye gets engaged, and I think you feel the depth. I think you know that you're in the presence of something else. The shirt has not been extruded from a machine. Something has made this thing, and you want to touch it, and you want to wear it. You want to talk about it. This is what we need today. This is what we need. We need to get excited again about the textiles that we live with so that we make a better, we have a better emotional investment in them, and we're committed to living with them for longer. We're committed to repairing them a little. We're committed to maybe over-dyeing them a little. We're committed to getting them the lifespan that they deserve and that the planet deserves, right? We need to move on from this idea that we're so vastly entertained by disposable product. It's time to finish that.
When I was in middle school, I think, middle school or high school, my mother works for Herman Miller, the furniture company, and she did a project for a division, I think it's closed now, called Millcare, that was their healthcare division. And she created this book called The Coherence of Color. It was a book and a video, and it talked about all this research that she and her team had done on color in healthcare. And they went and they researched whether painting walls a certain color or having the nurse's station be a certain color changes the feeling of the patient and the wellness. And they found actual results. And lots of hospitals are using this research now to decide which colors are in the hospital, because if you put certain colors around people, it makes them agitated. And if you put certain other colors around them, it relaxes them. And patients need to be relaxed and need to heal. And I thought it was a fascinating project. And it's something we don't talk about very much. We don't really talk about color in culture very much because it's such a specialized subject. There's so much information there.
I think it almost becomes, I know we're interviewing you, but I think it almost becomes creative thinking that a lot of people just block, period. I mean, I don't know what year it was that she wrote that book.
Probably 92 or 93.
Okay, so you're thinking about it, right? It's 22 years later, and it's only in the last few years that we've heard conversation about scrubs being in a different color to affect people.
It's definitely true. The psychology of color is fascinating. It's doubly fascinating when you think about how it shifts across cultures and how it even shifts across personal associations, right? There are great, like all generalities, there are beautiful exceptions and beautiful carve-outs. I know people who find blue depressing, right? Because it's a little chilly. That's why I like it, but it's a little chilly. There are people who love natural indigo fabrics because of the reflectivity, because of the complexity of the color. It's almost like certain intensities, as soon as you become aware of their backstory as well, certain intensities are exceptions to the rule. And I love finding those exceptions. Yeah.
So do you think, and now having done a lot of trend work, do you think that buyers or stores or individuals are, you know, usually you would hear, I'm not going to buy that color because it didn't sell, or buy brown, mark it down. I mean, I remember hearing that. You know, do you feel that they understand that kind of relevance, that they relate to color that way?
I think as animals, we all relate to color that way. But I think you made just a good statement a second ago about we do tend to block a certain amount of the information that we instinctually react to because there are a lot of other priorities that get put in front of us, right? We're not evaluated as professionals very often on how well we appeal to deep human instinct. We're evaluated more often on, you know, how our spreadsheets are working out, you know, comp over LY, right? There's a lot
exactly.
that gets in the way.
You're only as good as your numbers were yesterday.
You're only as good as your numbers were this morning. And somehow do we not have this thirst to have our instincts as humans brought into play when we engage with what we touch every day? I know, for example, I just did a quick retail sweep yesterday afternoon, just because, right? I'm a shopping animal. And it was interesting how few fabrics demanded that I reach out to touch them. And exiting my tour of six stores, it made an impression on me. And I, you know, to go back to the subject of natural color, it's not that I was necessarily requiring that my experience yesterday be filled with natural colors, but I definitely was looking for some reason to get involved with something that was on offer. And as a textile guy, I'm looking for texture, I'm looking for color, I'm looking for technique, I'm looking for something, right?
Right, something unique, and everything just kind of is in this way
zone.
Of sameness, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's in a zone. Mm-hmm. And for me, part of getting beyond that zone of sameness is grappling with sustainability issues. It is grappling with the idea that our bandwidth for cultural information is not being addressed. It's time, right? We've been through a really heavy period where the designer story was the creative story, and that was fun. And I think we have to dial our filters open to look now for other creative stories and other creative influences and let that poetry march in. Let those metaphors unify us. Let us have relationships with other people living other lives in other places that are positive because they're based on the beauty of culture, on the mutual respect that understanding somebody else's story brings. Let us engage with each other in a super positive, super vibrating, admiring way. And I think there are tools at our disposal to really bring the world forward as creators.
So what becomes your next step? And you have all of this knowledge and you have enough knowledge to start to move the needle on color. That's huge, right? And we're talking about the fact that not enough people are acknowledging that or talking about it. Mm-hmm. So how can you start to make a difference there? Or
sure.
What are you thinking you can do?
Sure. I feel very prepared to talk about the cultural background of lots of different shades of color, lots of different sources of color. And I think weaving that poetry into things is really great. I also think that there's a very healthy discussion to be had to look at any process and see what can be transformed in that process to eliminate waste and inefficiency and embrace differences of shade and texture. There's a good story in the book about logwood. Logwood is a hardwood dye and therefore, you know, not the most sustainable, right? If you're harvesting anything out of hardwood, you're doing something that's sort of a little challenging to the earth. Rubia, the company I mentioned in Holland, challenged a pair of designers who have a firm called Bureau Belen, based in Holland, to find a sustainable way of, a responsible way of using logwood. And the two young women realized that the dye machines of the weaving company that they were going to work with used up so much energy spooling and unspooling the yarn in the dye vat to ensure 100% sameness of every inch of yarn. There was a rigorous cleaning out and cleansing protocol at the end of every dye batch so that when the next batch started, it would be completely the same as the batch before it, no residues. And one by one, they eliminated steps, energy-consuming steps of this process to embrace the variations of color based on residue, based on slight differences in dialot, because it's a natural material based on slight changes of temperature, right, in the room at the time, what have you. And what they came up with was stunning. The ways that the yarn absorbed the color accommodated the different shades of purple, accommodated the leaching of subtle beige influences out to the edges of the dyed zones. The beauty that emerges from just letting it do what it wants to do were just amazing. Just amazing. And it makes me wonder how far we could push this in the creation of interesting product with stories behind it that is also more responsible than the products that came before it.
Anything with a patina is usually more expensive. So why wouldn't you go that direction?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. And, you know, happy accidents are also perceived to be so spontaneous that they should be more expensive. Let's embrace. Yeah.
I was at the trade shows over the weekend. It was the New York Fashion Week, trade show week, market week. And I walked a lot of floors. I saw a lot of booths. I saw a lot of, I've seen that before, I've seen that before, I've seen that before. I'm always looking for what's new, what's different, what haven't I seen before. And I didn't see a lot of what's new. I didn't see a lot of, oh my God, that's beautiful. I saw a lot of, okay, they think that's going to sell.
I would agree. I would agree.
There was one brand that I want to give a shout out to, Jota Kena, J-O-T-A-K-E-N-A. They are doing denim in Turkey, and it's two sisters from South Africa, and they had this embroidered denim jacket that was just out of this world. It was so colorful and beautiful. And only one of the sisters was in the booth when I stopped by, but she was telling me, you know, they had to do the flaps of the pockets on the jacket as separate embroidered pieces, and really, and it was, you know, more than double the price of anything else in their booth. And she asked me, you know, what would I advise her to do with the brand, because this was their first season. I said, you know, wholesalers aren't really going to pick you up very fast. They want to wait and see whether you stay in business, whether you're able to produce. And I said, just go for it. You're able to do this. Why isn't half of your rack things like this? You got to take the leap, because you got to stand out. If you're an emerging designer, if you're going out of the gate, you want to be noticed. You want to create absolutely gorgeous things. And if half of your collection is just show pieces that are for editorial that will have a hard time selling, that's fine, because all of it will have a hard time selling if you're an emerging designer. If you're doing your first collection and you're trying to do wholesale, don't hold the horses back. Really go for it and show what you're all about.
And sometimes things catch on. You know, there was one of the folks that I wrote a chapter about in the book is a group in Mumbai called Adiv Pure Nature. And at Adiv, they established a relationship with the biggest Hindu temple in Mumbai, the Siddhivinayak Temple, because they realized that marigolds, which are used by the millions across India as daily temple offerings, are natural dyestuffs. And so there are all these flowers being, by tradition, cast into canals, lakes, streams, seasides, because you have to dispose of an offering in the water to let the blessings of the offering dissipate into the universe. So they established a relationship with this Hindu temple to give access to as many marigold petals as they could possibly use. And they, through contact dyeing, steaming the petals into prepared fabric, or making a dye pot of marigold petals, have come up with this beautiful vocabulary of yellows into greens by adding a little iron. It was taken up by Christina Kim at Dosa, this idea of temple flower dyeing. She incorporated it into a couple of collections. It's been used a bit by Eileen Fisher in some collections. And people are really seeing the spiritual backstory of this as a plus, not just the pretty colors and textures, not just the fact that it's made by a socially and environmentally responsible group, but it also has a spiritual aspect. And the temple priests gave permission to do this because they saw that the dissipation of the blessings in water through steaming or dyeing was the same, it satisfied the requirement of tradition. And so what you're doing is you're wearing something that contains the blessings of the temple on your body. And for me, I'll take it. I think that's fabulous. It's a really lovely
thing.
And that's
a spiritual, unique story. And Charles, what you're talking about is a very unique technique, therefore making a unique design. So, and it's going to be very expensive, probably. You know, so I guess it's really is how to get these messages out.
Not that expensive. I mean,
oh, really?
It's denim with embroidery on it. It's not going to be that expensive, and they're producing it outside of the country. This is American Fashion Podcast. I like to promote Made in USA, but I also like to promote the idea of special pieces should come from anywhere. I mean, if you're making something remarkable, that can have a carbon footprint. If you're making something unremarkable, if you're making undershirts, don't make them on the other side of the planet. It makes no sense.
So I guess this also makes me think of designers here collaborating, now I'm looking at you, Keith, with some of the artisans that you've been working with, as opposed to, I'm sure each artisan is trying to develop their own business. And I know that that's difficult. So is there that cross collaboration already happening?
In places. It could always be happening more. Right. You know, when you think about the number of creative people, particularly in the textile field, in all these amazing countries, there are so many people ready for a respectful collaboration. And when I say respectful, I have seen over the years that there is a patience required to get started. You can't assume, right, that the people that you're talking with come fully loaded in the same way that you are to the sample development and ordering process. There is a period of exchange. There's a period of mutual understanding, trust. And, you know, there is an investment to be made. Let's not lie, right? Getting anything started that's new requires an investment of time and funds. But if we don't do that, we're always returning to the same well. And we know over time, as humans, we're geared to want something new. You're guaranteed to attrition over time if you only ever do the same thing. So if not now, when? Let's definitely take a journey and involve some new influences and new textures and new colors into the production process. But there are good relationships out there. It's lovely when it works. I think the Eileen Fisher Adiv Pure Nature example is a very good one. It's been, of course, respectful. Of course, there are results. And, of course, then it endures. But that initial investment happened, and now everybody's reaping the benefits of it.
Well, I think it would be great if you could kind of reach out to Stella McCartney and perhaps a key mill and start walking them through natural processes.
Well, all props to Stella. She's involved with the Ethical Fashion Initiative of the United Nations, which is run by a dynamic guy named Simone Cipriani out of Geneva. And I'm all for her involvement with that. It's just fabulous. Mm. So, you know, maybe others, we should do some shout outs to others to challenge them to to take the next step. But good for her. She's done some nice things. Yeah.
Looking for older episodes of American Fashion Podcast? Well, we actually ran out of space in our feed, so we have archived them, and you can find the archive at AmericanFashionPodcast.com. Archive is in the main menu, and that'll take you over to a platform where you can subscribe to the archive and support the show. That's AmericanFashionPodcast.com for all the past episodes. What was the goal of the book? And just to remind everyone, True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments is the title of the book, and we'll have a link to the book to purchase in the show notes. But what was your goal with the book? Who is the book for?
The goal of the book first was to tell the stories of these amazing creative people who deserve every bit of respect that we normally give to the people we consider designers, right? These folks, their discipline, their dedication to their craft, the body of knowledge that they represent is an important human asset. And, right, we owe it to them and to ourselves to get to know it better. The second reason to get involved with it was that the backstories of natural color are certainly aesthetic and certainly stimulating in and of themselves, right, just because of the colors that are involved. But the possibilities to enrich our daily experience goes beyond that visual stimulation. And when you start talking about environmental stuff, you start talking about spiritual impulses, you start talking about health impulses and the possibility that wearing natural color that comes from anti-inflammatory substances like turmeric may actually engage with our skin, the largest organ of our body, in a positive way, that maybe there's some sort of quantum poultice effect that we want in our lives as opposed to enveloping ourselves in petrochemicals every single moment of our lives, right? There is a richness and an intellectual engagement that I also think many, many, many of us are ready for, right? We're ready to think more deeply about something that we grapple with every day, right? Something we touch every day. All the textiles we wear, all the textiles we sit on, all the textiles we use to clean, to shelter, to why not be in a better dialogue with all these things? There's a line from Aboubakar Fofana, who's this amazing indigo master from Mali. Maybe we don't need so many clothes. Maybe we only need the right ones. And he was one of the first people that I interviewed in the book. And that line, you know, echoes in my mind. I have so much respect for him and what he does and why he does it. And we can talk more about that in a second. But I think challenging us as consumers is fabulous. He's right.
Now it's going to echo in my mind every time I open my closet.
It echoes in my mind.
I'm a little upset, I think.
Exactly. All right. So there'll be a beer with lunch, right? We'll make up for it. But one of the other reasons that I admire him is that he's very clear and communicative about, as a man with a very hard-earned body of expertise and knowledge, as someone who farms his own African cotton, his atelier spins and weaves and sews, he farms his own indigo in two varieties, Indigofera erecta and Lonchocarpus cyanescens. As somebody who ferments his own dye vats the way it was done, pre-synthetic, as someone who goes out to sell these goods himself, he often feels the pressure to be the cheapest kid on the block because it comes from Africa, because he's an African. And I think he's quite eloquent about saying, hey, wait a minute, right? Just because I come from Africa, why am I the cheapest kid on the block? Look at all of the command of resources and technique and talent and skill and visual acumen. He's a good designer. Why am I not the most? Why don't I get the most out of this retail interaction that I'm about to have with you? And as a result, he's really very selective about the people that he'll sell to. That's something for us to think about as well, right? What is in it? What is in it for the originators of these amazing things? And how can we make the commercial aspect of this a little bit more just and a little bit more good for everyone? It's a challenge. There's no doubt about it. I don't take that lightly. I don't think there's an easy answer to it, but I love the fact that he challenges us to think a little differently about it.
Color is so tied to poetry, as you mentioned, and just the word cyanescence as being the name of the plant for one of the types of indigo. Cyanescence. It's magical. Looking at your book and what it kind of feels like, it reminds me of the Very Hungry Caterpillar children's book, where it's pages and pages of color and the caterpillar kind of goes through the apple and all the other fruits and but for adults, it's so colorful and it's really, you've got kind of a rainbow effect as you go through the book because you're going through the different types of dyes in kind of what's the physics term, Roy G. Biv.
Yeah, Roy G. Biv. We started with black and white because I felt like we needed to gesture at black and white. Those are natural colors, right, depending on what you're working with. Yeah. And then we start with blue because I have to admit indigo is my favorite natural dye. I just find it so profoundly moving. At the end of the blues, we have a chapter on woad, which is a plant that very few people seem to be overly aware of. But woad,
I've never even heard of it. What is it?
Woad is a member of the mustard family. It's one of 600 plants around, 600 or so species around the world that yields blue content. It's slightly different from other plants because the precursors of indigo that it contains are called isotan, as opposed to indigotin. And this was the plant available to Europeans, right? This is the plant that was able to grow in northern climates. As soon as indigo made the scene, I guess really in the 17th century, as part of global trade, truly global trade, woad fell out of favor. But woad was producing gorgeous blues. It was incredibly important to the textile economies of England, France, and Germany. Queen Elizabeth I, at one point, issued an edict limiting the amount of acreage that could go into woad cultivation because she was afraid that the food supply was going to be endangered by the popularity of this blue-yielding plant. There was another thing that she put in limitation because the woad process used to use stale urine and it was quite stinky. No woad processing facility could be within a certain distance of any of her residences. So, you know, she was looking out for herself as well as for her people with these things. And then we move into all the other colors of the spectrum. Red is a big, of course, important part of the book, too, because it's been perceived with such high value for so long that the languages around red through madder root. We have 4,000-year-old dyed pieces of leather in the Metropolitan Museum of Art collection, which was a woven quiver, an arrow cover, that was apparently made in Ur in ancient Mesopotamia and made its way all that distance to be part of the grave goods of an Egyptian official because of the high perceived value of the color and workmanship. So think about luxury trade 4,000 years ago, that it was still in action, right? The Bottega Veneta of the ancient world must have been located in Ur and made its way all the way to Egypt.
Well, that's the oldest city mentioned in all literature is Ur. That's where Gilgamesh was king.
Yeah, I wonder if Gilgamesh liked red. And Enkidu, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
And so Uta Nimpishti, I love the names from that story.
Oh, so good, it's so good. So madder and cochineal, which is a beetle-based dye. These beetles were domesticated by the ancestors of the Zapotec well over 2,000 years ago, and it still provides some of the most beautiful red colors because it's willing to lean towards blue. So you get these gorgeous blood-red blues from it, depending on how you treat the fiber and what you add or don't add to the dye bath or what you do or don't over-dye. In the process. I spent a week with a family of Zapotec dyers and weavers, the Gutierrez Contreras family from Teotitlan del Valle in Oaxaca. And in a couple of days, Juana Gutierrez Contreras showed me how she makes 26 different shades of red, burgundy, violet, purple, coral, orange, all based in her work with the cochineal dye. And it should be a little more familiar to us than it is because it's one of the safest red colorants, and it is actually a colorant labeled E120, which is used in certain foods and cosmetics even today. So we have Betelgeuse on our lips, some of us from time to time, whether it's through juices or lipsticks.
I'm going to try to not think about that, but are you about to talk about our visitor earlier?
Someone was mentioning that there's a red dye used in cosmetics that's becoming very hard to get. The cost of red dye, certain red dye, is going up. Do you know what they might have been talking about?
I don't. I wouldn't be surprised if it was cochineal because it is a farmed substance and it does have a lot of uses and it is very safe. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is going to be a huge problem.
Well, then let's hasten ourselves to Ethiopia because a South American company introduced cochineal into Ethiopia because there's a kind of cactus that the bug apparently likes to settle on and eat. And the company went bankrupt, but now cochineal has escaped cultivation and it's a total pest across large parts of Ethiopia. So the cochineal beetle is waiting for anyone who cares to cares to cash in.
So the lipstick can be saved.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But think about the safety of it. It's an organic molecule and a fairly stable red color. So
fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think this book is visually stimulating, inspirational, and educational.
I'm glad that that was really what I was hoping for.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as I had mentioned before, something to bring a little respect and attention to these amazing people whose stories we so rarely get to hear.
Mm-hmm. Keith, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
That was my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, the Archives. With roughly 250 episodes published, the old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online on Twitter. We are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show. And I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.